just go ahead and get started. Because what I want to talk about today is kind of a very large topic, and I want to try to give you an overview of a bunch of aspects of that topic and hopefully leave a little time at the end for questions. And I just so this is the second part in the two-part talks I'm doing about dog park science. And I like to talk about dog park science because dog park is one of those places where, as someone who knows a lot about science, I find myself doing a lot of informal science education just, you know, in the park, talking about last time my colloquial talk was about the evolution of dogs, which is a question that always comes up and I talk a lot about. And this time I'm going to talk about a little bit about the neurobiology of dog training. And a little background about my experience with dog training. I am not a dog trainer. I don't have any formal training in dog training or in animal training at all, although I always wanted to be a lion tamer. I do, however, have a lot of experience training animals, and specifically training monkeys, rhesus macaques, for my thesis research. I worked with rhesus macaques, and I studied their behavior. I studied the neurobiological basis of their behavior. So the first thing we had to do in any of our studies, before we even got any data, was to train these monkeys to do these very complicated behavioral cognitive tasks with millisecond resolution. So in order to do the experiments that I wanted to do, I needed to learn an awful lot about animal training very quickly. And in my field, if you weren't good at training animals, you weren't going to get very far. Because if it took you years and years to train an animal how to do this thing, you would never get to what you were supposed to be studying, which was, you know, the behavior itself. And so a lot of what I'm going to tell you is kind of rooted in my background in that. I'm also a dog owner, and when I got a dog, I realized, oh, you know, all these things that I've done with monkeys are the same things that these books are telling me to do about dogs. Now, my other background in this topic is, in addition to having to train monkeys in order to do my experiments were about reward and about how reward was integrated with sensory information. And of course, rewards are very important to training and to learning. So, you know, when you think about training, any animal, and everything I'm going to talk about today, because dogs are mammals, and humans are mammals, and mice are mammals, everything that I'm going to talk about today is equally applicable to all these animals. And I'm actually going to quote once from an article in the New York Times, one of the science writers wrote, where she took all of a lot of the things that I'm going to talk about in this talk and tried to apply them to her husband. Quite successfully, actually, and her husband actually starts to turn them around and use them on her, and I'll send that article out after this. But the reason why I think this is such an interesting topic is not only is this a hot topic in science right now, in neuroscience, but it really is applicable to you and I and the way we deal with each other and actually train our children and our spouses and our coworkers. So when you think about training, what we're really interested in is, you know, behavior. We want to create a behavior or change a behavior, and we know that we do that with rewards. We know that, you know, when somebody does something we like, we reward them, we praise them, and we hope that this is going to change their behavior. And so behaviors result in rewards, and those rewards influence behaviors. So in order to think about how training and learning goes on, we need to think about these three components. We need to think about behavior, we need to think about the reward, and we also need to think about how they're linked. All right? So the first thing I'm going to talk about is behavior. I'm going to talk a little bit about the psychology of behavior and the way you should think about behavior when you're trying to train an animal. Then I'm going to talk a little bit about reward, and that's when we're going to start to get into some of the neurobiology. I'm going to talk about some of the current thinking in neurobiology about what rewards are and what that means for training. And then we're going to dive more into the neuroscience in the link, right? Because that's what the brain is really doing. The brain is really linking behavior and rewards in order to learn. And if anyone has any questions at any point, just you know, shout them out or raise your hand, let me know. So, behavior. the key thing to thinking about behavior when you're training an animal is to realize that behaviors are built up slowly. They're sculpted, right? Just like an artist starts off with a block of wood or a block of marble and doesn't just, you know, instantly carve what he wants in it. You know, he slowly works up the form, you know, he roughs it out and then adds more detail and polishes it out and builds it up slowly and shapes it. That's the same way you have to think about behavior. You don't just create a behavior, you build it up slowly. And the reason why you can do that, and the reason why you should think about building it up slowly, is because behaviors are not binary. They're not either present or absent. And you shouldn't really think about behaviors as, you know, oh, I want my dog to not bark when strangers come in. What you really want to think is, I want my dog to be less likely to bark when strangers come in. Because, of course, you want your dog to maybe bark when some strangers come in, those that are unwanted late at night. So, behaviors exist along distributions, and the key to training from a behavioral point of view is to realize what distribution you're shaping and think about it and think about slowly shifting that distribution from where it exists to where you want it to be. Yeah?
Isn't this true of all learning?
Is this true of all learning?
Yeah.
So the things that I'm going to be talking about today are learning really simple things. Uh-huh. But yeah, this is the basis of all learning. I mean, this is the, you know, teaching a dog to sit or teaching yourself to, you know, move your hand through a maze that you can't see. These are the simple, repetitive behaviors that I'm going to be talking about today. But these are the foundation for learning much more complicated things. There's probably a lot more going on when you learn more complicated things and more cognitive tasks, but it is all rooted in this core behavior, in this core system. So this idea is called shaping by approximation. And this is a great quote that I think really sums up the idea of shaping. This is from that Times article where the science writer took all these things and applied them to her husband. She says, "You can't expect a baboon to learn to flip on command in one session. Just as you can't expect an American husband to begin regularly picking up his dirty socks by praising him once for picking up a single sock. With the baboon, you must first reward a hop, and then a bigger hop, and then an even bigger hop. With Scott the husband, I began to praise every small act every time. If he drove just a mile an hour slower, tossed one pair of shorts in the hamper, or was on time for anything." Right? And think about that baboon. If you're trying to train a baboon to flip, how do you do that? I mean, the baboons don't flip. But if you can get the baboon to hop, and you reward him for that, and you train him to do that, then you train him to hop more, and pretty soon, you know, if I could do a flip, I would. You can get them to hop. But this is the key idea. Starting with something you have that exists along a distribution, and moving that distribution to where you want it to be. So in the lab, I want to give you two examples of how to do this. One is how I would do this in the laboratory, just to show you how the kind of scientific basis of this. I had these monkeys and I wanted them to do certain things with millisecond resolution. So if I trained them to look at a target when I flash it on the screen, so the monkey was sitting there looking at a computer screen, and when I flashed a target, he had to look at it. And let's say I wanted him to do that in under 600 milliseconds, which is really easy for a monkey to do. Well, the first thing I would do is I would train him to do it, and then I would measure all the times he took. I would just reward him for doing it every time. Looks at the target, gets a reward. Looks at the target, gets a reward. And I measure each time how long it took him to look. And then I make a histogram, a frequency histogram. So here are the durations of the behavior. So here are the times when it took him 100 milliseconds. Here are the times when it took him 800 milliseconds. And here are how many times. This is just a count of how many times it took him to do that, okay? And I look at this distribution, and right now, when I start off, he's getting rewarded for all of these. So your first instinct might be, well, to say, okay, I'm just not gonna reward him for anything more than 600. But that's actually a big chunk of times where he's not gonna get rewarded. And that's not so much shaping the distribution, that's more just trying to like cut it in half and make it what you want it to be. So what we would do instead is we would pick just this very tail end, just this small fraction of trials, And we would draw a line right here at about, say, 900 milliseconds. And we'd say, okay, monkey, you don't get rewarded if you take 900 milliseconds. So, you know, I flash a target and he goes to look at it, and if it took him 900 milliseconds, he simply doesn't get the reward. And I do this a lot. And it's just a small number of times, maybe even 1 out of 100 times when he doesn't get this reward. But eventually, when I look at the distribution, it looks like this. All of a sudden, I don't see any of these long ones, and the whole distribution is shifted over here. Okay? And then, and this might have taken a week, this might have taken a month, depending on the monkey. And the point is, one thing to keep in mind is doing this is slow and tedious, and moving slowly can be one of the biggest challenges in training animals, but it's also one of the most important. So then we pick another spot, say right over here at about 600, and we go through, you know, the process again, and all of a sudden, now I've got the distribution where I want it to be. And if you look here, what we've done is rather than just cut it here, we've just slowly shifted the distribution to where we want it to be. All right? And yeah, Julie?
Is there any bias or benefit to biasing your reward, like greater reward for a quicker time, or is that not the same?
There are lots of games you can play. You can say, okay, you know, we're going to give you more reward for you know, the times that are within our range. But if you do that, what you'll tend to find is he'll just be more, you'll increase those that are in the range that you want, that you'll reward more, but he'll still do the longer ones when it makes sense. That's the amazing thing about these monkeys and these tasks, is they will find the little path that gets them the most reward possible. Yeah.
Right. So we only looked at reward. There's the other side, which is punishment, and that's not included in this. And I'm just wondering if there's
I'd like to kind of punt on punishment for now. Maybe we could talk, because punishment is a much more complicated topic. And I'll say this idea of, you know, sparing the rod and spoiling the child, that rewards are better at teaching than punishment, there is some neurological basis for that. And at the end of the talk, I'll come back to this. I think we'll be in a better position to discuss it. Yep.
I was curious how you might determine an appropriate interval, because if you're doing something with a response time of 6 milliseconds, you'd be tempted to say, oh, I only have the work done fast, I'll do it every 2 seconds or something. But obviously, the reward isn't that meaningful if they just got one 2 seconds ago. So, how do you determine what an appropriate interval is?
With the monkeys?
Yeah, or in the
You know, let's hold that question in for a minute, and we'll come back to that when we get to the middle part about linking rewards and behaviors. But choosing the rate at which rewards are given is an important factor. So this is how we would do it in a laboratory, and you know, it's really easy to do when you can monitor every behavior to millisecond resolution and record it all. But how do you do this with your dog, which is, you know, really what I want to talk about today? So. Here's this classic problem. How do you teach a dog to high five? Right? Or this can be, you can generalize this to pretty much anything. But if you just go up to a dog and you say, high five, he's gonna look at you, he's not gonna do anything. You can do that 100 times, and the dog will never probably raise his paw and slap your hand. So how do you reward, how do you begin this process? How do you reward a behavior that you never see? If the animal has no idea what do you do? Where do you begin? And this is where this idea of shaping really takes root. Because what you want to do is you want to start with an approximate behavior that the dog already knows. You want to, you know, a lot of people, you'll see a lot of people, they'll pick up the dog's paw and hit it to their paw and say, oh, high five, and do it for them. That's not a very good way to go about doing this. What you really want to do is find something the dog can do, that the dog does naturally, and build upon that. And even if it doesn't resemble the behavior at all, what you want to do is find something that you could see a path from where the animal is to where you want him to go. You want to imagine that whole path, right? That's the distribution. You want to slowly shift the behavior towards that. So what you can do is you can put a treat in your hand and hold it down low by the dog's paw. And a lot of dogs will naturally just, you know, claw at a treat that they want. And you say high five, and you put your hand low, and you just reward just the dog just raising your hand, just touching it a little bit. And you reward that very heavily until the dog is very regularly just touching your hand very low. Right? It's not a high five. You're saying high five. It's not the behavior you want. you're rewarding some other behavior, which is just touching your hand down low, but then you slowly raise it. You raise it up maybe a quarter of an inch. You know, you pay attention to the animal, you see how much they're learning, and you very gradually shift that distribution so that the animal knows, okay, when you hold it at chest level and you say high five, he's got to hit your hand. And then you reward not just for grazing, but for really, you know, intentionally landing the paw right on top. And then you slowly work your hand up, you know, to the high five position, and very, very slowly, pretty soon, when you hold your hand up and you say high five, the dog knows what to do. All right? So this is the idea of shaping by approximation. And this is how you should really think about behaviors and how to get from the behaviors that you have to the behaviors you want. You want to do it subtly and slowly, and you want to work from a behavior. You always want to start off with a behavior. So now, I just want to give a couple more general training tips about behavior, and then we'll move on. So this idea of shaping is a very general concept, because it's not just, you know, once you build up a very simple behavior, and you have a little vocabulary of behaviors, you could then, through the same process, start building those behaviors up into much more complicated behaviors. And this is how you do things like train your dog to get a beer from the fridge. You don't try to train that all at once. First you train the dog to go to the fridge, then you train them to open it, and then you start stringing these together into much more elaborate behaviors. And an important thing is consistency. Consistency, consistency, consistency with your verbal commands, with and your visual commands. If you want the dog to high five, always say high five, not high five and gimme five, right? These are, in our mind, those are the same thing, but in the dog's mind, they're very different. So consistency is really important. And be consistent about when you give rewards. If you set a little rule, okay, the dog needs to land his paw squarely on my hand, don't waver from that. Be rigid, be consistent. And only train a time when the dog is focused and capable of succeeding. I think that's a pretty obvious one. But people often try to train their dog when they first get home because the dog is excited. That's usually not a good time. And training for short periods is usually better for training for longer periods. Training for short periods more regularly. And you can see a lot of these things are, like Charlie said, things that we use in education generally. But this is a really interesting one. Don't punish unwanted behavior, right? A good trick with dogs is to simply not acknowledge that behavior. Because a lot of times punishment for a dog is when you punish it, you yell at it, and you scold it, you're sometimes giving the dog what it wants, which is your attention. That attention may be negative in your mind, but to the dog, it's still interacting with you. So a really good trick, and one that I've found to be really successful, is when a dog does something you don't want, become really interested in the ceiling. Just totally ignore them. Starve them of what they want most, which is interaction with you. And doing that can be a powerful reinforcer. And another really subtle idea that we could probably talk a lot more about, but we're just going to mention here, is it's difficult to train a dog to not do something. What's easier is to train a dog to do something that is incompatible with what you don't want him to do. And this is a really important and subtle idea. If you think, well, I don't want my dog to bark so much, training a dog to not bark is an incredibly difficult task. But training a dog to bark on command is much easier. And once you train a dog to bark on command, they'll be less likely to bark without that command. Okay? Are there any questions about shaping?
Yeah, what is the distribution of your holding and food in your hand and say high five?
So what you'll see is sometimes they miss. You'll notice that it's not just that an animal won't, you know, the dog won't touch your hand or will touch your hand. Sometimes he just grazes it, sometimes he gets a little bit more, a little bit off, and those are the little distributions that make up a bigger distribution.
This is a binary distribution.
Well, you need to pick a point in the distribution. So his behavior will exist along a distribution. Sometimes, you know, he'll put his paw right on you, sometimes he'll just graze you. And everything between that is the distribution. But you need to pick a point in that distribution and only reward one part of it. Okay. So now I want to move on to talking about rewards. Because one of the most important factors in training is having a good reward. But what is a reward? It seems very intuitive what a reward is, But really what we're discovering in a lot of neurobiological studies of reward is that it's a little bit more subtle than originally thought. An important thing to keep in mind is rewards are defined functionally. All right, and this goes back to the psychology of Skinner. Rewards, all a reward is something that reinforces behavior. That is, it just has to work. It just has to make a behavior more likely to happen. Rewards are defined functionally. And the concept of rewards is often conflated with the idea of pleasure. Right? Often when I talk about giving a reward, you think it's got to be something that's necessarily pleasurable. But one of the most radical and subversive ideas that's come out of a lot of neurobiological studies of reward is that liking something and something being reinforcing are entirely different systems in the brain. Right? That things can be reinforcing, things can be rewards that are actually unpleasant. And this has really changed the way we think about drug addiction, for example. When drug addicts say, oh, you know, I did not want to do that. I did not want to snort that cocaine or inject that heroin, but I found myself doing it, right? It's, you know, they really don't like doing it. It can be really unpleasant, physically, psychologically. It can be a negative experience, and yet they find themselves doing that. And that's because these two systems are very separate. For example, let me take a quick poll. Which do you think is a better reward for training a dog, sugar or salt?
Salt.
One vote. Anyone else think salt? So who says salt? Raise your hand. Who says sugar?
I'll say sugar just for the heck of it.
Sugar for the heck of it? Well, more people said sugar. And usually that would be your gut impulses, that something really pleasurable, like sugar, is a better reward than salt. And this is actually true for laboratory rats. I'm going to tell you a little bit about an experiment done by Peter Schizga a couple of years ago, where he found, he took sugar water and salt water and used rats and tried to train them. And he found that if you just took two rats and started this experiment, tried to train them to do something simple like push a lever, that the sugar water was a much better reinforcer, a much better reward than the salt water was.
Yeah. How did he come up with an equivalency between sugar and salt?
That's
a taste thing, so it's kind of subjective.
Well, let me finish telling you about the experiment. So he started with just sugar and salt, and he found that rodents preferred the sugar water. And then he did something interesting. He took them and he deprived them of salt in their diet. Okay, he removed all of the salt from their diet, and all of a sudden, they weren't interested in the sugar water. They became much more responsive to the salt water. Now, the question is, did the salt water taste any better to the rodents, to the mice? Was it a more pleasurable experience? Did it all of a sudden become a better gustatorial experience? Probably not. But it became a better reinforcer because it was what they needed and wanted right then and there. Okay? So just because something is pleasurable doesn't mean it's a reward. And just because something is not as pleasurable doesn't mean it won't be a good reward. So the key idea, or a more general way to think about this idea in terms of training dogs, is to reward the dog with what they want most. For a lot of dogs, most of the time, that's food. Dogs love food. But food is not always the best reward. The best reward at any given point is what the animal wants most right then and there. And I use this trick with my dog all the time. Even though he loves food, sometimes food isn't what he wants right at that moment. Sometimes what he wants is to just keep doing what he's doing. And I think of this as continuing the action. So for example, my dog, when my girlfriend moved in, she brought her dog in, and my dog learned from her dog to start to jump up and down a lot when I reached for the leash to take him out. It was very exciting. He would start to jump up and down. It drove me up and down the wall. So what I did is I would make moving forward with the going out to the park contingent upon him sitting down and being still. So he would start to jump. I would reach for the leash, and he would start to jump up and down, and I would just put the leash down. I just wouldn't continue going forward with things until he sat down. And then I would move the leash closer, and if he started to jump up and down, I would put it back up on the shelf. So the reward was not food. The reward was just getting him what he wanted, getting him closer to getting to the park, to getting out. I did the same thing when he started to tug on his leash and pull towards things. I would just stop. As long as he was putting tension on the leash, we would go nowhere. And this worked amazingly well. And the key idea is to use what's most effective. And thinking about what's most effective is part of the trick to animal training. It's not just always to use food, but use what is most effective at any given time. So another general set of tips about rewards and animals. When you do use food rewards, they don't need to be big. Big rewards, you know, a big chunk of meat is really no more effective at rewarding a dog than a small chunk of meat. And we'll talk about why this is in a little bit, but what's important is not the food itself, but it's more the getting of the food. So you can use just a little bit of food, this will keep your dog thinner, and also make using food a more effective reward for a longer period of time, because he won't get as satiated. Rewards that are variable in some way are more effective than static rewards. So if you always use kibble as a reward, if you chop some of that, good goose liver reward in with it, just a couple little pieces, that's more effective than using the good stuff all the time. Secondary reinforcers, which is an idea we'll talk a lot more about in the next section, so-called clicker training. Who here has ever heard of clicker training? So, clicker training is very powerful. It's called a secondary reinforcer. And that's what we're going to talk about a little bit more next, is why these secondary what secondary reinforcers are and why they work. So are there any questions about some of these ideas about rewards? Okay. So now we're going to move on to the last part of the talk, which is how the brain integrates behavior and reward, how it links rewards and behavior. And the brain faces a really interesting problem when trying to link rewards and behavior. This is called, in neurobiology, this is called the credit assignment problem. And the idea is that a reward at one moment needs to influence behaviors that have occurred in the past. Right? The animal has done some behavior that has resulted in the reward, but the behavior is in the past relative to the reward. So that reward, the brain needs to figure out a way for the reward in the present to influence behavior in the past. And a lot of times that behavior can be milliseconds, hundreds of milliseconds, seconds, even minutes in the past. And that's a really tricky problem for the brain to solve, is to work backwards in time and have something in the present influence something that happened way in the past. And so the brain has a system for doing that, and it's the dopamine system. I'm sure you guys have all heard of dopamine, right? Who has never heard of dopamine before? So when I say dopamine, what are some of the words that come into your head? What do you think about when you hear the word dopamine?
Neurotransmitter.
Pleasure.
It's a neurotransmitter. Pleasure. Right.
Drugs.
Drugs, right? So neurotransmitter, these are all the words that I expect you to say. Dopamine has long been talked about, and even to this day, I still hear neuroscientists on the radio talk about dopamine as the pleasure neurotransmitter. And here it's reached into our common vernacular. People say, oh yeah, I felt really good. I got my dopamine firing. And it turns out that while dopamine probably does play a small role in the feelings of pleasure, it plays a very small role. That the feelings of pleasure are probably mediated more by the serotonergic and the opioid system. And what dopamine really is, the real role that dopamine is playing, is dopamine is the brain's teacher. It's a teaching signal. And this is part of this idea of it being, of pleasure and reinforcement being in separate systems. That this dopamine system is what's more responsible for reinforcement and for learning, and that there's this other system that is more responsible for hedonics, feelings of pleasure and satisfaction. And it's not as simple as that. I mean, let me keep that all in mind. I mean, anything about neurobiology is never simple as this does this and that doesn't, right? And dopamine also plays several roles in the brain. Dopamine is involved in movement. That's why Parkinson's disease, which is when dopamine cells start to die. But one of the major roles that dopamine plays is in rewards. Particularly, there's a part of your brain called the ventral tegmental area, the VTA. And in that part of your brain are a little cluster of these dopamine cells. And they have these long projections called axons that reach out from the center of your brain, from your brainstem, this kind of old part of your brain, to the rest of your brain, to your entire neocortex, right? They send out all these projections all over your brain. But most of them, a lot of them, go to the front of your brain, your frontal cortex, which is involved with coordinating behavior. And these neurons are constantly leaking out. They're constantly giving just a trickle of dopamine, just constantly releasing a baseline level of dopamine. And this one of the roles that dopamine is playing is, we believe it's playing a large role in strengthening neural connections. And this is how the brain works, right? There are these connections between neurons, and when a behavior needs to get stronger, those connections get stronger. And when a behavior needs to get weaker, those connections need to get weaker. And your behavior is just a matter of how neurons are, how strongly they're wired to each other. And dopamine has the ability to make that connection stronger or weaker.
So define stronger.
Define stronger. By stronger, I mean that the neurotransmitter released from one neuron will have a greater impact on the next neuron. So it's just a connection of communication. There's information being passed from one neuron to another with these electrochemical signals called action potentials. And by strengthening the connection between them, you make that information more likely to pass from one neuron to another.
Physically, what's happening?
That's a good question. In fact, this entire idea of dopamine strengthening neural connections is a very complicated one, and one that there's still a lot of research about. But basically what we're talking about is them growing physically closer together, there being more terminals, and physically growing, getting closer together, and having a stronger impact on each other. Right, and it can also influence Right. So when a neurotransmitter gets released, there are receptors on the other cell that receive that neurotransmitter and allow it to act on it. And if you have more receptors, the neurotransmitter can have a greater effect. If you have more neurotransmitter, it can have a greater effect. So this is all incredibly complicated. But these dopamine cells do some really interesting things that allow them to act as the brain's teacher signal. And they respond to these rewards in two unique ways that allow them to do that. The first is that they really do respond with what we've come to think of as a teaching signal. And I described the dopamine as the brain's teaching signal. I didn't just pick that word out of a hat. The signal that these dopamine neurons use can really be thought of as a teaching signal. Because they don't just respond to reward. It's not a reward signal. It's not the case that when you give an animal a reward, the dopamine neurons fire. A little bit more subtle than that. What they do is they increase the amount of dopamine they're releasing for unexpected or better than expected rewards. All right? And they stay the same, they don't increase their firing rate, they don't release more dopamine for expected rewards. And they decrease the amount of dopamine that they release for rewards that are expected but not received. Okay? So let me give you an example. If I go up to a dog and I reach into my pocket and I give the dog a treat, you know, a little slice of bacon, these dopamine neurons fire, right? They increase their firing rate. They release a little bit more dopamine because the dog wasn't expecting a reward. It was an unexpected reward, which these cells really like. And if I did it again, we'd probably get another little squirt of dopamine because, again, it was unexpected. But if I keep just standing there, you're giving the dog treats, right? The dog will keep taking them and keep eating them and get fatter and loves them. Oh, bacon, give me bacon. But at a certain point, he'll start to expect that reward. And these dopamine neurons will stop firing. Okay? This is a really important idea, because just because you're giving this animal a reward, this little slice of bacon, doesn't mean that it's having an influence. It doesn't mean that this teaching signal that actually links the reward to the behavior is doing anything. And this is one of the big differences between a fully learned behavior and a training behavior, which is the degree of reward prediction. Okay? So I'm sitting there, I'm giving the dog these little slices of bacon. We start and we get a bunch of dopamine impulses, and then after, you know, 1,500 times when the dog really expects it and knows exactly when it's gonna happen, this dopamine response stops and we just go back to baseline. But then all of a sudden I stop. I reach out and my hand is empty. Then the dopamine neurons do something different. They pause for a minute, they shut down and don't release as much dopamine. And this is a little bit, we understand how, and this is used so that this is a signal to say, okay, what you just did is not good. This, something's changed, right? We're not getting the rewards that we wanted. So this idea that it's not just a reward signal, but a teaching signal. What dopamine neurons are really signaling is important information, right? Literally information, when there's information out there in the world. An unexpected reward is a little piece of information, right? But a constant reward, there is no information there, right? It's background. But the absence of reward, all of a sudden that is information again, all right? And in fact, there's an even more, I wasn't gonna bring this up, but there's an even more subtle view of this signal, which is actually has nothing to do with reward, but just has to do with information and salience out there in the world. And that's something you'll start to hear more about in the coming years in popular science articles about dopamine and learning, is this idea that it's really not even about reward, it's just about information and salience. And keep these dopamine cells in the back of your head while you hear about it. So this is part of the way in which dopamine extracts reward and uses it to influence behavior by either strengthening or weakening these connections. But these dopamine neurons do something even more amazing, which is that they can become associated with reward predictors. And what is a reward predictor? Well, it's exactly what it sounds like. It's something that predicts a reward. So if I have a little beeper in my hand, and I've got the same dog, you know, my little bag of bacon treats, and I hit the button and it beeps, and then I give the dog the reward, and it beeps and it gives the reward. Let's say I wait 30 seconds between when I hit the beeper and I give the dog the reward. Hit the beeper, give the dog the reward. Does this sound familiar? This is what clicker training is, right? You click the little thing, you give reward, click, give reward, click, give reward. You do that a bunch of times. Now, what starts to happen is the dog is getting an unexpected reward when it gets the reward, and so the dopamine neurons fire. And then as that reward becomes expected, it also becomes something else, becomes predicted, right? There's something in the world, the click, the beep, that the dog is learning that predicts a reward 30 seconds from now. So the response to the getting of the treat, the getting of the bacon, disappears, but it doesn't disappear entirely. It gets transferred to the sound of the clicker. So that when you click, the dopamine neurons increase their firing rate, and the reward comes. Now, why is this important? This is important because what this does is this allows the brain to temporarily separate the reward from when it occurs. Think about when you tell your dog to sit. When you say, sit, and the dog sits, and you want to reward him. You just reach into your pocket, you give him the treat. Think about all the things that have happened. Maybe it took a second between when the dog's butt hit the ground and when you got the treat into his mouth. Think about all the things that happen. A second is a long time as far as the brain is concerned. All the things that happened between those two. The dog was wagging its tail, it looked over here, a truck went by, you know, maybe the beeper on the alarm clock went off. The brain needs to know which of these things is responsible for the reward. The dog's brain doesn't know it's because it hit his butt. It could be anything. And if you just give a reward, all it does is associate the reward with what happened most immediately. But with a secondary reinforcer, you can associate it, you can separate it out in time. So when the dog sits down and you hit the little clicker, as soon as his butt hits the ground, what you're saying to his nervous system is that right there is what I want to reinforce. Don't worry about when you get the treat. This is what we're interested in reinforcing. So not only does it allow you as a trainer to precisely control when you deliver this teaching signal, it allows the brain to slowly take this teaching signal and separate and find back in time the thing that it should be reinforcing, all right? And you're all pretty much familiar with secondary rewards because this is the way slot machines work. You ever wonder why slot machines are constantly making all this noise and flashing all these lights? They're secondary reinforcers. You sit down on a slot machine and you put some money in and it's blinking, it goes bing, 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 and gives you a small reward. You think, oh, that's great. And you keep playing and it keeps giving you very small rewards. It says bing, 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 gives you, makes a little noise and gives you a very small reward. Reward, noise, small reward. But then all of a sudden, you stop getting the reward. But you're still getting the bing, 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 bing. And you don't even notice it. But what's going on is your brain is that is reinforcing you sitting there and plugging money into the slot machines, right? I actually thought about giving this talk entirely in terms of slot machines, because slot machines are almost perfectly engineered to take advantage of this system. Everything about them, there are these perfect little training boxes.
So that's just mean dogs are playing people as slot machines?
In a lot of ways, yeah. So that's pretty much all I'm gonna give you. I feel like this was an awful lot of information, both very general and very specific, but I'll stop there. We've got about 10 minutes for questions, so if anyone has any questions.
What happens when you go through this training process and gradually your pet forgets how to do that if you don't reinforce it all the time? Is that strengthening of the neuron transmissions disappear?
Yeah. There's these connections between neurons are very dynamic, and they're constantly, there's a lot of, maybe you think about it in terms of competition. And if things aren't being reinforced, then they get beat out by other things that are being reinforced. So yeah, these connections can weaken if they're not reinforced. But the real details of how those connections get stronger and weaker, that's something that's still a really active area of research and debate about how that actually happens.
Sorry, I'm a little bit confused. Is dopamine a chemical that is released by?
Yes, it's a neurotransmitter, it's a molecule.
Okay, so it comes out of the neuron
mm-hmm.
and it goes mm-hmm. to other ones.
Mm-hmm. So neurotransmitters are, you've heard of them, other ones like serotonin is another neurotransmitter that I'm
sure.
Does
it come from a specific region in the brain?
It comes from specific cells. So each cell in the brain only releases one neurotransmitter. So when we say a dopamine neuron, what we mean is a neuron that produces and releases.
But dopamine neurons are throughout the brain.
There are dopamine neurons throughout the brain, but there tend to be different clusters of these types of neurons. So for example, there are in their brainstem, there are a couple of different little clusters of dopamine neurons. And some of them are doing different things. So the neurons in the VTA and the dopamine neurons in the VTA and in a couple of other areas are, we believe, largely responsible for this teaching signal. But there are dopamine neurons in another part of the brainstem that are responsible for motivating behavior and moving you. And if you start to think about these two things, those are really similar things, because approaching behavior, walking up to something and taking it, is very linked to it being rewarding. And they're playing separate roles, and a lot of it has to do with the time scales in which these neurotransmitters are released. But yeah, there are different groups of dopamine cells in the brain.
Okay. I was just going to add that physically what you have is, if you can imagine a nerve cell resting above another nerve cell or muscle cell, and right along the very tip of that are a series of tiny bubbles that contain neurotransmitter, and those are released when a nerve impulse, which is a major electrical signal that's happening in a nerve cell, transits across that area, and it causes those bubbles to merge with the surface of the nerve cell, so it squirts out basically. And that happens very quickly.
So dopamine is released, it goes to a specific place.
Yeah, it gets released. It released. So a neuron has this long axon. It sits in your brainstem, and it sends a very long axon to, say, the front of your brain, the frontal cortex, which is involved in organizing much more complicated behaviors. And it has this little terminal out there. And inside this terminal are these little bubbles filled with neurotransmitters. And then that connects to another neuron, right? Every neuron is communicating to another neuron. And it releases that neurotransmitter. and it drifts into a little gap between the two, mm-hmm. and then it binds with receptors on the other side. And that opens up these receptors, and when enough of these receptors get opened up, that next neuron sends one of these electrical impulses, mm-hmm. and that causes its neurotransmitter to get released onto another neuron. You put billions of these together and wire them up, and all of a sudden, you can play soccer.
There's also chemicals that kind of destroy this complex after the transmission has happened.
Yeah, there are ones that, so this neurotransmitter gets reabsorbed and gets broken down and reabsorbed by the neuron that released it and absorbed by other cells and it diffuses and it's all very complicated. Yeah, Luigi.
So, of course,
the
room expands towards attention.
Yeah.
And the control and distribution of attention. In fact, a lot of, like, what you were saying about salience and information can also be viewed through the lens of how you manipulate attention through salience stimulating the environment rather than how you can view, like, a teaching signal of what you learn.
Right,
so
right.
Does that have implications for, like, how you train at all?
It does. And so this idea that dopamine is, you know, and a lot of these models that we have, each one is limited in its own way. And this idea of the teaching signal, there's a lot of math and computer models and computer simulations that use this idea of a teaching signal that are amazingly successful at robotic learning and computer learning and also have a strong physical basis. But so for example, we were talking about negative encounters or punishment. A lot of these dopamine cells respond in a very similar way to negative stimulus, to air puffs in animals, or to shocks, right? And part of the idea is that, well, those are just as important for learning as well, right? You also want to, you know, it's a little thorn in the side of the model of why these cells fire. But this is what brings up this idea of, well, maybe what they're really signaling, or part of what they're signaling is, hey, something just happened and you need to pay attention to it. This has information. There's information out there in the world that needs to influence your behavior. And that information, some of it is good, you know, some of it is a positive experience and some of it is a negative experience. And again, this is this idea of the feelings of good and bad being separate from the teaching signal, right? So this idea of salience is saying, well, what's really important is the information out there that rewards have, and the information that punishments have. And it doesn't matter whether they look good or not, these are things that you need to pay attention to. And the very act of paying attention, and in fact, I studied reward, and one of the biggest conceptual problems in studying reward is there's no way to really separate rewards from attention. So the effects you see in the nervous system when you make something more valuable are almost identical to the effects you see when you have an animal pay attention to something. So a lot of people who studied attention said, oh, you're not studying reward, you're just studying attention. And people started to say, well, you know, let's not play semantic games like that. Maybe these are all the same thing, right? Maybe something, rewards, things that are more valuable draw our attention, and things that draw our attention tend to be, you know, valuable in some ways. So that's where this idea of this kind of, it's almost a loosey-goosey idea, and people are struggling to figure out a way to quantify it, but this idea of salience, of information, of importance. And this is used to bias behaviors, whether it's a positive stimulus or a negative stimulus. So
one of the questions that I've had with respect to this is that it's very difficult to shape behavior, as you were talking about. It takes a number of trials and you go through this long process. My dog, and this has happened with other dogs, learns a negative experience for like one trial. It's like if you get your nose burned, if your fingers burned, you don't want to do that again, and you don't. It's not a shaping question. It's like, that's bad. And that all seems to be very black and white to them, and I was just curious as to whether or not, if it's the same mechanism or...
So what tends to happen with... So people, when you first start to train monkeys or get into behavioral neuroscience, some, you know, you always ask, well, why can't I punish the monkeys? Why, you know, maybe they would learn faster if we give them a little air puff or, you know, something like that. And what happens is negative experiences tend to bring about a whole series of behaviors called withdrawal behaviors.
Yeah.
And as soon as you introduce, if you have an animal under study, as soon as you introduce a negative, a punishment, basically, the animal will just disengage entirely, right? Just even once, some animals are incredibly sensitive to it, and they just won't engage in the behavior at all, right? And that is what a lot of punishment does. So when you get burned by something, it's one way to think about it is that it's not so much that you've learned that this is bad. What you're doing is you're just avoiding it, right? And if you, it's an entire avoidal mechanism, and it's not as powerful and as robust as learning and getting a new behavior. All you've done is said, I will not approach that. You've negated behavior, right? So when a dog gets burned by the stove,
yeah.
It's not so much that it's learned the stove is bad, it just avoids the stove. It does not approach the stove. And this is this other role that dopamine plays in terms of motivating you to walk things. And another little interesting story about dopamine and about Parkinson's patients and rewards, I remember when I took clinical neuroscience, we learned about a patient who had very bad Parkinson's and had a lot of trouble getting across, you know, walking around. And you know, they gave him a walker to help him, you know, get moving. And once you start to get moving, a lot of times it's easier. And then one day he was in the doctor's office, and there was a candy bar on the other side of the room. And he was able to just get up and walk very easily in his candy bar. And you know, what the idea was is that this approach, you know, that these dopamine neurons were involved in generally in approach behavior, right? And in motivating. And that's the whole reason why we're moving around all the time, is to go up to things and look at them, right? Not to run away from them. And when you had a really powerful thing out there, like a candy bar that you really wanted, even though there was so little of this motivating dopamine in his system because he had Parkinson's, it was enough. It was such a powerful one that it was enough to get him to go and get it. So this idea that dopamine also plays a role in approach behavior and exploring behavior is really important. And what punishments do is tend to shut that off and push it in the opposite direction, which is avoidance. Any other questions? Applause.